Yes. But then miscommunication in the dark led to confusion, and the attack just disintegrated, with some panicky units even fighting one another. The Athenians were badly demoralized by all this, and they now found themselves effectively besieged in their own camp. Also, their traditional superiority at sea began to erode in the face of attacks by Syracuse and its allies. Recognizing that the expedition had failed, Demosthenes urged a withdrawal, while the forces were still intact and in decent order. Even at this late point, Athens could simply have left and suffered really little or no ill effects to their overall war effort. Once again, however, Nicias dithered. He said he had to wait for orders from Athens. But finally, even he had to recognize that the game was up, and so he agreed to an evacuation. Then, on the very eve of departure, a lunar eclipse occurred. The extremely superstitious Nicias took that as a bad omen, and he announced that he could not move until he had performed the prescribed period of ritual purification, which lasted 3 times 9 days. Saying this, he promptly retired to his tent and refused to consider any action. That delay was fatal. By the time the 27 days of rituals were completed, the Athenians had been trapped by enemy forces. An attempt to break out ended disastrously, with the loss of almost all the ships. The completely disheartened Athenians now desperately tried to escape. They abandoned their camp, marched along the coast, but the whole attempt was badly organized, and all of the scattered Athenian columns were simply slaughtered by the triumphant Syracusans. Nicias and Demosthenes were both captured and executed. The surviving troops were sold into slavery or condemned to labor in a quarry where most of them perished. Of the vast armada that had set out from Athens, none returned. In the words of the great Greek historian Thucydides, quote, "They were beaten at every point and all together. They were destroyed with a complete annihilation. Their fleet, their army, everything was wiped out." The Peloponnesian War would drag on for another decade. But really, from this point on, Athens was on the ropes. And eventually, it was forced into a humiliating, unconditional surrender. The disaster of the Sicilian expedition had been the decisive turning point. Even if the initial idea for the expedition was ill-conceived, it's fascinating to see how many opportunities the Athenians squandered to maybe change the outcome. If they had not allowed political infighting to result in the recall of Alcibiades, if they had struck quickly upon first landing, if they had pressed their initial advantage, if Athens had not voted to double their forces rather than just abandoning the attempt, if Nicias had taken Demosthenes' advice to withdraw, if Nicias had not let that eclipse delay him, changing any one of these might well have resulted in a very different outcome and avoided Athenian defeat. Many of these blunders stem from problems with leadership, whether that was being seduced by the charisma of Alcibiades or appointing Nicias to a role that really he was temperamentally ill-suited for. The story of the Sicilian expedition offers up to us a rich feast of errors and broader lessons. For example, if engaged in a war on one front, don't provoke a war with a new enemy on a second one. Beware of politicians who are motivated primarily by self-interest. A divided command is rarely a good idea. If you adopt a daring plan, do not appoint a cautious commander to carry it out. Don't invest in a losing enterprise. And above all, know when to cut your losses and just walk away. Finally, what of Alcibiades? What happened to him? Well, his stay in Sparta was cut short when he was discovered having an affair with the wife of one of the Spartan kings. Alcibiades escaped the king's wrath by fleeing to the Greeks' traditional enemy, Persia, where he somehow ingratiated himself with the Persians and urged them to support him in a coup to seize control of Athens. Meanwhile, though, Alcibiades also opened negotiations with the Athenians and, astonishingly, somehow persuaded them to allow him to come back to Athens and to reinstate him as general there. Returning to Athenian service, Alcibiades won a string of spectacular victories against the Spartans. But then, after losing a battle, once more he ran away. This time he escaped to the kingdom of Phrygia, with the intent of continuing on to the Persian court. But before this could happen, assassins found and killed him. Who hired those assassins remains a mystery. He certainly had no shortage of enemies. But many believed it was the Spartan king, seeking revenge for Alcibiades' seduction of his wife. If that's true, I suppose it could be considered a fitting end, in which the consequences of his own actions finally caught up with him. Thank you.
Lecture 3. Carre, the Parthian Shot.
The Roman war machine was one of the most successful in history and has been widely admired for its organization and its discipline. Tough Roman legionaries literally carved a path from one end of the Mediterranean to the other. And in the process, they created one of the world's greatest and most enduring empires. By virtue of their professionalism, Rome's armies became accustomed to winning victories, even against foes with vastly superior numbers. In 53 BC, at the Battle of Carrhae, however, the Roman military suffered one of its most complete and humiliating defeats, one in which a first-class Roman army of over 40,000 men was wiped out by an enemy only a quarter its size. How this shocking defeat occurred is a story that, on the Roman side, involves glaring intelligence failures, overconfidence, and poor decisions. While conversely, their opponents made crafty use of the terrain, identified and then ruthlessly exploited weaknesses in the equipment and tactics of the Romans, and finally deftly manipulated an overeager Roman commander into a fatal trap. By the 1st century BC, the Roman Republic had begun to collapse under the strain of internal tensions, and also due to the actions of ambitious politicians, men like Marius and Sulla, who undermined the institutions of the Republic in their own quest for power. In the next generation after them, the dominant figures were Pompey the Great and Julius Caesar. Through Pompey's spectacular conquest of the East and Caesar's famous campaigns in Gaul, both of those men established their credentials as highly skilled generals. Of the two of them, Pompey was the elder, and he had made his reputation first. But by the mid-50s, Caesar had elevated his status to really become Pompey's equal. Those two men were not the only powerful politicians jockeying for supremacy at Rome at this time, however. There was a third man whose wealth equaled or even surpassed theirs, and who also had already had a long, successful political career. His name was Marcus Licinius Crassus, and he, Crassus, would be the general who would lead the legions to disaster at Carrhae. Crassus came from an old, respected aristocratic family. And during his youth, when the struggle between Marius and Sulla was taking place, he had been a member of Sulla's faction. In fact, at one point when Marius' group had the upper hand, Crassus had been forced to hide out in a cave in Spain for 8 months. Crassus is an interesting figure. He's arguably as close an approximation to what we might call an entrepreneurial business tycoon as one can find in all of Roman history. Crassus was said to have started out with a family fortune of about 7 million sesterces, and that put him among Rome's highest elites. But among that select group, this was not a particularly exceptional amount. To try to put Crassus's 7 million sesterces in perspective, consider that a Roman daily wage laborer would have had an annual income of around, let's say, 1,000 sesterces. And the minimum to qualify to be a Roman senator was 1 million. By the time Crassus embarked on his final expedition, he had multiplied his initial inheritance of 7 million sesterces many times over into a vast fortune that amounted to nearly 170 million sesterces. That's a staggering amount, and by the way, that's the largest private fortune that we know of in ancient Rome. Crassus amassed this huge sum through a combination of clever strategies. The most infamous of these was the manner in which he exploited the city of Rome's susceptibility to fires. Nearly every night, there were serious fires that would start in and destroy the city's buildings, most frequently the high-rise apartment buildings that much of the populace lived in. This situation was exacerbated by the flammability of building materials, by the densely packed nature of the city itself, and the lack of any effective firefighting force. What Crassus did is he organized a personal firefighting brigade of 500 of his slaves. And then, when a fire broke out, he would rush to the scene and offer to buy the burning structure for a token sum. The desperate owner, seeing his building and his wealth going up in flames before his eyes, would have no choice but to sell to Crassus in order to at least recover a little bit of his investment. Crassus would then order his men into action, put out the fire, and purchase the slightly damaged structure for a bargain price. And in this way, Crassus bought up much of Rome, becoming history's first great real estate magnate. This was just one part, though, of Crassus's diversified portfolio of investments. He acquired a number of rich silver mines, along, of course, with the slaves to work them. He also established what amounted to a rent-a-slave business, in which he would first train the slaves in skilled trades and then rent them out for lucrative fees. Finally, he operated as a kind of first century BC loan shark. He'd lend people money and then collect interest on those loans. He frequently used his wealth to advance his political career, currying favor with selected colleagues by offering them loans at attractive rates. Among those who took advantage of his financial patronage was the young Julius Caesar. And the two men, Caesar and Crassus, remained allies throughout the early phases of Caesar's career. On the other hand, Crassus and Pompey were already rivals, and their existing dislike greatly increased due to an incident during the suppression of the slave rebellion of Spartacus. What happened is Crassus had played a primary role in putting down that revolt, and so he was anticipating winning the resultant military fame. But then at the very last minute, Pompey jumped in and stole away much of Crassus's anticipated glory. Despite these tensions, all three of these ambitious politicians were at heart pragmatists. And once they had all risen to a position of dominance at Rome, they realized that, at least in the short term, they had more to gain if they worked together. So they created an informal alliance. And this is something which has become known as the First Triumvirate. and its purpose was to control the Roman state. Their arrangement involved divvying up the Roman world, with Caesar continuing his campaigns in Gaul to the north, Pompey basing himself in Spain to the west, and Crassus being allotted Syria on the eastern frontier. While the members of the triumvirate were notionally equals, Crassus was keenly aware that one area in which Pompey and Caesar enjoyed superior reputations to him was in that of military conquests. Crassus was a modestly competent general, but he really had the misfortune here to be allied with two of the greatest commanders that the ancient world produced. And Crassus felt that he would never really be acknowledged as their equal until he had won similar laurels on the field of battle. Of course, for anyone in the ancient world, the ultimate military role model was Alexander the Great. And Alexander had earned his name by conquering the mighty Persian Empire. Roman Syria was situated near the borders of the Parthian Empire. The Parthian Empire was the contemporary heir to Persia, and it occupied a similar geographic region centered more or less on Mesopotamia. Crassus set off for Syria in November of 55 BC. Plainly, he was harboring dreams of emulating Alexander by conquering Parthia, the east, and thereby elevating his military reputation up to a level equal or maybe even beyond that of his two colleagues. The army that Crassus commanded was a typical Roman one of the time, and that meant it emphasized heavy infantry. These were the famed Roman legionaries, tough, well-trained foot soldiers who were equipped with large shields and heavy armor, and they fought mainly with the gladius, a deadly short sword. Crassus was allotted 7 legions, totaling about 35,000 men. In addition, he had 4,000 lighter-armed auxiliary infantry and a contingent of 4,000 light cavalry. Among these were 1,000 Gallic horsemen, which were to be contributed by Caesar and who were commanded by Crassus's own son. In a traditional set-piece infantry battle in which the Roman legions could calmly march forward, smash into an enemy formation, and chop them up with their swords, that sort of army had repeatedly proven itself irresistible. And so Crassus was confident that his victory over Parthia was all but assured. In contrast to the excellent heavy infantry of the Romans, the Parthians employed very different types of troops. The army that confronted Crassus at Carrhae had almost no infantry at all, but instead was mostly composed of mounted warriors. And these came in two basic varieties. Most numerous were horse archers, who wielded powerful compound bows. These men were lightly armored, and they practiced a style of warfare in which they darted towards their enemy on their agile mounts and then spun around and danced away before coming into direct contact. And all the while they were doing this, they would unleash a constant rain of deadly arrows. The famous maneuver in which these horse archers would dexterously twist backwards in the saddle to fire off an arrow as they rode away has become known as the Parthian shot. The second type of mounted Parthian warrior were known as cataphracts. These were mostly Parthian noblemen who were mounted on especially large horses, and they were completely encased in heavy armored coats. These were made up of small overlapping metal scales. It looked like the scales of a fish. And they would carry long lances. Obviously, they were not as nimble as their archer compatriots, but these cataphracts could sweep ponderously forward in a thundering charge and impale or trample their foes. Crassus arrived with his army in Syria in mid-54 BC, and from there he moved on into northern Mesopotamia. He initially met with success. He subdued a number of wealthy towns, he defeated some of the local Parthian administrators. Crassus then settled down to wait until the following spring to resume his campaign. And in the interval there, he devoted his time to organizing his newly won territory and in tallying up all the captured loot. The ancient sources are harshly critical of this delay. They accuse Crassus of wasting entire days personally overseeing the weighing out of the treasure taken from temples. And in the process, he neglected the training of his men. Plutarch claims that during this period, Crassus, quote, acted more like a businessman than a general. While a dashing general might have plunged forward against Parthia without delay, this sort of halt for consolidation was really not that unusual. And Crassus was also still waiting for the arrival of his son along with those 1,000 valuable Gallic cavalry that had been promised from Caesar. Nevertheless, the pause did give the Parthians time to prepare. The current king of Parthia was a man named Orodes II, and he had recently attained the throne in a civil war. Orodes raised two armies to defend against the Roman invasion. The main army, which he commanded personally, was poised on the border facing the neighboring kingdom of Armenia. At this point in time, Armenia was a Roman ally, and so this constituted a likely invasion route. Orodes also ordered one of his noblemen to put together a second army from his own retainers and to position it so as to oppose a potential Roman advance straight into Mesopotamia. This nobleman was from the clan of Surin, and thus he's commonly referred to as Serenus. Serenus was the second most powerful man in the Parthian Empire after the king Orodes. And the king plainly viewed Serenus with suspicion as a potential rival. Orodes no doubt hoped that if the Romans moved directly into Mesopotamia, they would encounter, fight, and almost certainly overwhelm Serenus and his army. And from Orodes' rather cynical perspective, such conflict would accomplish the double goal of removing an internal rival while also conveniently whittling down the Romans so that Orodes himself could move in and finish them off. Serenus, however, had no intention of being Orodes' sacrificial pawn. Apparently only in his late 20s at the time of Crassus' invasion, Serenus was a dynamic and clever leader. Despite his youth, he had established a considerable reputation for bravery, and furthermore, he was regarded as the most handsome man in all of Parthia. When traveling, he allegedly was always accompanied by no fewer than 200 wagons bearing his considerable harem of concubines. Serenus assembled an army of 10,000 men, and of these, 9,000 were rapid-moving horse archers, while 1,000 were hard-hitting cataphracts. Orodes was really not eager for a war with the Romans, and so in a last-ditch effort to avert it, he dispatched an envoy to Crassus to try and make peace. Crassus, though, was primarily after military glory, not additional wealth. He didn't need it. And so he brusquely rejected this offer, and he told the messenger that the Parthians would know his response when he stood triumphant in the Parthian capital of Seleucia. On hearing this arrogant declaration, the Parthian ambassador laughed, and holding out his open palm, he declared that hair would grow upon it before Crassus set eyes on Seleucia. The major decision facing Crassus was what route to invade by. One option was to take the longer path through the allied state of Armenia. The advantage to that was that the Armenians could provide water and supplies along the way, and the Armenian king would join his army with Crassus, which would add 30,000 infantry and 10,000 invaluable horsemen to the force. The other option was to continue directly into Mesopotamia. That was a shorter route, but it would take his army through a desert. Eager for glory, Crassus declined the offer of help from the Armenians, and he pushed straight on into Mesopotamia. The sources, which admittedly do tend to be hostile towards Crassus, claim that he took the advice of a local Arab chieftain who volunteered to be his guide through the desert, but that the Arab was really in league with the Parthians, and so he led the unsuspecting Romans out into a desolate wasteland where they could easily be ambushed. Crassus then marched squarely into the zone defended by Serenus. And despite being outnumbered 4-1 by the Romans, the wily Parthian picked a spot astride Crassus's path and prepared to engage him. The Roman legionaries would have been laboring forward through the sand in their hot, heavy armor. And on June 9th, 53 BC, as Crassus paused beside a river, a group of his scouts encountered Serenus and were repulsed with heavy losses. Although his men were already fatigued from marching all morning in the hot sun, and his officers counseled camping for the night in order to properly scout out the enemy, Crassus hastily cut short the water break and ordered his men forward. And thus began the Battle of Carrhae. The Roman advance was a bit confused, with the men originally arrayed in a long line of infantry with the cavalry on the wings. This was a standard Roman battle formation, and it was one that Crassus's officers advised him to adopt. After already deploying that way, however, Crassus changed his mind, and he ordered that the Roman soldiers rearrange themselves into a colossal hollow square. This order must have produced a good bit of grumbling in the ranks, as the already tired legionaries trudged back and forth across the parched landscape, assuming first one formation and then another. On the other side, Serenus had arranged his men in a manner that concealed their numbers, and he instructed his cataphracts to wear robes that disguised their heavy armor. Serenus began the battle with a charge by his cataphracts that he himself led. With a cacophonous roar of battle cries mingled with drums, trumpets, and bells, the cataphracts threw off their concealing garments and rumbled forward. It was at this moment that Roman discipline and experience really showed their value, because the men hunkered down behind the wall of their shields and fought off this dangerous assault. Serenus wisely did not press the attack, but he withdrew his cataphracts and now instead sent forward the 9,000 horse archers. These encircled the Roman square, riding in and unleashing volley after volley of arrows. Whenever the heavily laden Romans tried to run out and engage them, the agile horsemen just darted away, firing a few more arrows over their shoulders. This experience must have been extremely frustrating to the Romans, to be tormented by a foe who fled just out of reach whenever they tried to strike back. But Crassus and his men were probably not too worried yet. They knew that the archers would soon exhaust their store of arrows, and if they could just endure the storm for a short time, they then might get their opportunity. Now, however, the genius of Serenus was fully revealed. Before the battle, he had organized 1,000 pack camels into a continuous relay that delivered fresh loads of ammunition to his archers on the battlefield. After firing off a quiver of arrows, the archers could just grab a new one from the nearest supply camel and thus maintain a steady rain of arrows on the beleaguered Romans. Now, things were looking much grimmer for Crassus. The powerful Parthian bows were demonstrating an unnerving ability to penetrate the Romans' armor, and casualties were steadily mounting. The Roman infantry were unable to close with their mounted opponents. Crassus decided that the best bet was to attempt a breakout using his own small group of cavalry, supported by the few archers that he possessed, and about 4,000 infantry. The core of this group was the 1,000 Gallic horsemen led by Crassus's own son, Publius. He was put in command of the overall breakout attempt. Publius bravely advanced with his men, and the Parthians at first gave way before them. This retreat encouraged the Romans, who at last seemed to be getting the upper hand, and so they swarmed forward, chasing the fleeing Parthians. Once again, however, it was a trap, and as soon as Publius's force was too far from the main square to get assistance, the Parthians turned and fell upon them. The heavy cataphracts crashed into the more lightly armed Gallic cavalry, and a savage melee ensued. The Gauls did fight desperately and with spirit. They would dive under the bellies of the Parthian horses to stab at the only point that wasn't armored. After a sharp battle, the Romans were surrounded and cut down. Publius and the few survivors took refuge on some high ground. With the enemy closing in and with his right arm disabled by a wound, Publius ordered one of his aides to kill him. Out of about 5,000 Romans who took part in this attempt, all but a few hundred were slain. The victorious Parthians chopped off Publius's head, stuck it on the end of a lance, and brandished it aloft to taunt Crassus. According to the sources, Crassus bore the death of his son stoically. He kept going around the square and giving encouragement to his troops, but everyone knew they were now in a bad position. The hail of arrows resumed, more men fell victim to the merciless shafts, and the morale of the soldiers plummeted. The Romans gained a temporary respite when night fell, and the Parthians discontinued the assault until the morning. At this point, Crassus still had maybe 20,000 combat-capable men, and so he now decided to attempt to sneak away under cover of darkness and save that portion of his army. The problem was, this meant abandoning thousands of wounded men on the battlefield. And when the survivors began moving off, the anguished cries of those who were being left behind alerted the Parthians to what was happening. They, however, declined to interfere. And so Crassus was able to withdraw back a little ways to the town of Carrhae, where there was a small Roman garrison already there. At dawn, the Parthians advanced over the battlefield and slaughtered all of the wounded who had been left behind. Although Carrhae's walls afforded good protection to the Romans, there was simply not enough food or water to endure a siege there. Crassus's army also seems to have really just been falling apart under this accumulation of disasters, and it now fragmented and split up into different groups which individually tried to escape. A few of those were successful, but most, including Crassus's, were caught. Serenus offered to parley with Crassus over surrender terms, and a meeting was set up. During the negotiations, however, a scuffle broke out, and in the general chaos, Crassus and those with him were killed. Of more than 40,000 Romans who had marched into Mesopotamia, 20,000 now lay dead, 10,000 more were captured, and fewer than 10,000 broken survivors trickled back to Syria. This was one of Rome's greatest military disasters. The removal of Crassus from the triumvirate paved the way for a showdown between Pompey and Caesar. And in the aftermath of that, we really saw the complete overthrow of the Roman Republic. This struggle for power was, of course, ultimately won by Julius Caesar, although he himself then fell to assassins' daggers a few years later on the Ides of March. Their victory at Carrhae also firmly established Parthia as Rome's main rival, and it effectively curbed further Roman expansion to the east for a while. The Battle of Carrhae illustrates a number of lessons. First of all, it's a classic example of how a strategy or a tool that works well in one situation can turn out to be entirely unsuited to a different context. In this case, the heavy infantry of the Roman legions, who had been invincible on so many battlefields against formations of infantry, when they were placed in the open desert, they were completely unable to deal with a swift enemy mounted on horseback and practicing hit-and-run missile warfare. Similarly, Crassus's behavior provides a cautionary example, demonstrating that one should respect one's limitations, and you should stick to what you're good at. Crassus, there's no doubt, was a superlative politician and businessman, but he was, at best, a mediocre general. Additionally, his overconfidence led him to make a number of crucial errors, including neglecting to bring sufficient cavalry and archers of his own. He spurned an ally's aid. He failed to properly scout out an enemy and the terrain. And he didn't listen to experienced advisors. Repeatedly, he allowed his eagerness for battle to lead him right into traps. Perhaps one of the saddest footnotes to the battle is the fate of Serenus, that talented and energetic general who had so ably outfought and outfought Crassus. Rather than earning him the gratitude of his monarch, Serenus's triumph only increased Orodes' fear of him as a rival. And so, Serenus's reward for saving his country was to have trumped-up charges brought against him, and by order of King Orodes, he was executed. Thank you.
Lecture 4. Red Cliffs, Cow-Cow's Bad Day.
Even outstanding commanders can have a bad day. And that seems to have been the case at one of the most celebrated conflicts in Chinese history, the Battle of Red Cliffs in AD 208. The general who made the uncharacteristically poor showing at Red Cliffs was a warlord named Cow-Cow. Sometimes his name is pronounced Cao-Cao or Chow-Chow. He has subsequently become a near legendary figure. He's often portrayed in fictionalized accounts as a scheming, villainous, and manipulative character, one who is willing to commit any crime in his lust for total power. The reality, though, is more complex. There is no doubt that Cao-Cao was a ruthless and ambitious man, but he was also a savvy politician. He was an able administrator whose policies and reforms benefited many in China. And he was a renowned and influential poet. Among his talents, Cao-Cao was a clever general. He even wrote several quite well-regarded treatises on military strategy and theory. By the time of the Battle of Red Cliffs, he had already amassed a long record of victorious campaigns. On that day, however, his army suffered a disastrous and embarrassing defeat that permanently ended his dreams of consolidating all of China under his personal control. The effects of his uncharacteristic loss at Red Cliffs were significant, as the failure of his attempt at unification had the result of precipitating the chaotic and violent era of political fragmentation, which has become known as the Three Kingdoms period of Chinese history. By 190 AD, the once mighty Han Empire, which had ruled China for nearly four centuries, was beginning to weaken and totter, and internal tensions threatened to tear it apart. The Han Empire was one of the great empires of world history. It encompassed more than 60 million inhabitants and 1.5 million square miles of territory. This was roughly equivalent to the Roman Empire of the same era. And it also presided over a golden era of Chinese civilization. As the 2nd century AD wound down, however, the Han Empire was faced with dynastic infighting. This was sparked by the court eunuchs who tried to seize power. And also, there was a serious uprising of peasants, which was known as the Yellow Turban Rebellion. The result of these challenges was effectively the collapse of the central government. The emperor was forced to flee. The empire broke up into at least 8 different sections. Each one of these was controlled by a warlord. Usually these were former Han generals. Many of these warlords claimed to still be loyal to the imperial family, and they at least officially said that all they wanted was to restore the Han dynasty. And while this may indeed have actually been true for some of them, others were plainly just out to grab as much power and territory as they possibly could. Of these men, one of the most able was Cao Cao. He came from a quite well-connected family, he received an excellent education, and he was appointed to various civil and military posts that enabled him to rise rapidly in the ranks of the bureaucracy. There's a lot of stories about his somewhat wild behavior as a young man, including one that he was completely addicted in his youth to falconry and dog racing and spent all his time doing those things. Another says that once, as a lark, he invaded a wedding and molested the bride. And furthermore, he evaded punishment for this by successfully shifting the blame to one of his comrades. It's clear that Cao Cao greatly enjoyed the company of women. Ultimately, he would have 2 official wives, no fewer than 13 concubines, and we know of at least 32 children that he acknowledged as legitimate. In contrast to these sensory diversions, Cao Cao evinced a strong interest in several more intellectual pastimes. And most notable among these were poetry and military strategy. He avidly read every work that he could find on military theory. And then he went on to compose several treatises of his own. Among these was a summary of all known military tactics, and another book which was really one of the first commentaries on Sun Tzu's famous The Art of War. The style of subject matter of Cao Cao's poetry, which he wrote throughout his life, would influence later poets, particularly those of the Tang era. Much of Cao Cao's poetic output has been lost, but one surviving sample goes, "The wine is poured, and it is time to sing. For how long is the life of a man? We may compare it to the dew at dawn. So many days are sadly now past, a noble heart can brave such melancholy. But it is hard to ignore anxious thoughts. How shall we relieve our distress? Except with the wine of Du Kang." Cao Cao's career really took off during the Yellow Turban Rebellion. At that point in time, he was appointed as an officer in the cavalry, and he was dispatched to a district and charged with suppressing the peasant uprising there. He energetically carried out this task, and in the process, he won a reputation as a brave and able commander. That, of course, led to further missions, and when they were successful, to more promotions. By the mid-190s, when the government had collapsed, the emperor had been effectively deposed, and the Han Empire had disintegrated into more than a half dozen regions controlled by rival warlords, Cao Cao survived the chaos, and he emerged from it as one of those feuding warlords. His geographic stronghold was Yingxuan, in northern China, and he portrayed himself as the rightful protector of the emperor. He said that he was only concerned with working towards the emperor's restoration. And the emperor himself endorsed some of these claims. At times, the emperor sheltered with Cao Cao. He bestowed upon him some official titles, and he recognized him as the official governor of several large provinces. Of course, on the other hand, Cao Cao's critics accuse him of manipulating the emperor for his own private purposes. And they asserted that he planned to eventually dispose of the emperor and to seize all power just for himself. Whatever his ultimate intentions may have been, Cao Cao now embarked on a long, extended series of campaigns whose aim was clearly to conquer the other regions of China and to reunify the country. The first order of business was to consolidate his hold over the north. His main rival in this area was a general named Yuan Shao, whose army was more than double the size of Cao Cao's. Nevertheless, Cao Cao confidently began his campaign. He adroitly lured Yuan Shao's army onto ground of his own choosing. And then he whittled away at the larger force with a whole series of feints and attacks. Sometimes he would deliberately give up ground in order to entice a section of Yuan Shao's army into pursuit, and then he would ambush that isolated unit. All of these little successes piled up and served to raise the morale of Cao Cao's army, as well as disheartening, of course, his opponents. The turning point of the entire war occurred when Cao Cao sent some raiders to destroy and burn several of Yuan Shao's supply depots. He also attacked and burned an entire convoy of supply wagons. Cao Cao then fell upon the starving and discouraged army of his enemy and completely routed it. This conflict, which is usually referred to as the Battle of Guandu, took place in AD 200. And it's still studied, even today, as a model for how to use a smaller force to overcome a larger one. It also shows how logistics can play a role in warfare. In gaining his victory, Cao Cao demonstrated his mastery of many of the precepts of strategy advocated by Sun Tzu. Among these are employing deception, utilizing the terrain to your advantage, demoralizing your enemy, attacking the enemy's weak points, and, as I said, being attentive to the importance of logistics. Cao Cao spent the next 7 years in further conquests. The stage was now set for an attempt to move into southern China and to add that region onto his already existing domains. By now, the major players in China had pretty much been reduced down to three main warlords and their respective territories. You had Cao Cao in the north, you had Sun Quan in the south, and Liu Bei to the southwest. Liu Bei was Cao Cao's most intractable foe, and he's an interesting character in his own right. Often he is portrayed as the hero in many of the sort of semi-fictional accounts of this era. He was said to be extremely tall and somewhat gangly, with oversized ears so large and protuberant that he could see them out of the corners of his eyes. He came from a poor family, and, like Cao Cao, he had made his name during the Yellow Turban Rebellion. When that revolt broke out, Liu Bei volunteered to join the fighting in defense of the emperor. And he did well, and he ended up commanding what really amounted to a private army. His success in that role then earned him an official appointment. And from that point on, his career prospered. When the entire Han Empire collapsed, the complicated politics of the time saw him joining several factions, and he became an opponent to Cao Cao. Eventually, basing himself in the southwest, he consistently professed himself to be a staunch Han loyalist, and he claimed that his only aim was to attempt to restore the imperial dynasty. Liu Bei is also famous for having a number of rather colorful companions. These included one man who is a mighty warrior, but whose chronic impulsiveness and hot temper repeatedly got him into trouble. Another was an equally valiant fighter and was renowned for his exemplary sense of honor. Of all of this entourage, though, perhaps the most important in the coming war was Zhuge Liang, who possessed a reputation as a brilliant military strategist. He's credited with devising a number of truly ingenious ploys that would help Liu Bei in his struggle against Cao Cao. The third warlord, Sun Quan, was less openly hostile to Cao Cao, but he was an ambitious general whose goal was to establish a kingdom and hopefully to found his own dynasty of rulers. The main conflict between Cao Cao, Liu Bei, and Sun Quan was sparked in 208, when yet another of the seemingly innumerable Chinese warlords of this time died. And this precipitated a power struggle for his former territory. This warlord had been the ruler of the important province of Jing, which controlled the central section of the Yangtze River. This was one of the two main rivers of China, and it was a vital communication route. Jing bordered the territories of all three men. So Cao Cao, Liu Bei, and Sun Quan each naturally desired to obtain it. Liu Bei's bid to control it was thwarted by Cao Cao, who knew that he absolutely had to have this important transportation node if he ever hoped to be able to take the south. Cao Cao not only acquired the territory, but he gained the allegiance of the former ruler's military. As befits a region which was centered around a river, the main part of that force consisted of 70,000 marines and over 1,000 boats. With those soldiers added on to his own, Cao Cao was by far the most powerful man in China. He was now able to call upon a vast army, said to number 800,000 men. While the actual figure was maybe a quarter of that amount, he still clearly had far more than any of his opponents. Cao Cao's old enemy, Liu Bei, was determined to prevent Cao Cao's further expansion. But he commanded only around 10,000 men. So if he hoped to do that, he needed to find allies. The natural person to turn to was Sun Quan, the third major warlord. Unfortunately, Sun Quan and Liu Bei had a long-standing animosity. Each also knew that if they did manage to defeat Cao Cao, they would quite likely end up fighting one another. Nevertheless, the menace of Cao Cao was so pressing that Liu Bei sent his aide, Zhuge Liang, this is the crafty strategist, to meet with Sun Quan and attempt to forge an alliance, however unlikely. Meanwhile, Cao Cao also sent a message to Sun Quan, knowing that he would have an easier time conquering the south if he could keep Sun Quan and Liu Bei divided. This document declared, "A recent imperial mandate honors me with the task of punishing rebels and traitors. My troops have pointed their banners to the south. My forces total 1,000,000 mighty men under 1,000 commanders. I invite General Sun Quan to join me in a hunting expedition for Liu Bei and his forces. This will seal an eternal alliance between us. Reply quickly." This message arrived at Sun Quan's court just before Liu Bei's ambassador Liang got there. A famous debate now took place, with various of Sun Quan's advisors advocating different paths of action. Most of them urged Sun Quan to accept Cao Cao's offer, and Sun Quan seemed to starting to be leaning that way. However, when Sun Quan took a break to go to the bathroom, one counselor followed him there and privately pointed out that the other advisors were arguing for what was really in their own best interests, not those of Sun Quan. And this was because if Sun Quan submitted, Cao Cao would probably allow them to retain their high positions. But Sun Quan would surely lose all that he had. At this, Sun Quan decided to defer his decision until he had heard from Liu Bei's ambassador, Liang. The next day, Liang was brought before Sun Quan. But for all his supposed cleverness, Liang initially completely bungled this assignment. He offended Sun Quan by excessively praising Liu Bei. He did, though, quickly realize his error, and so he switched tactics. He said that Liu Bei did not really need his help, because Cao Cao's northern men would be fighting in swampy territory that they were unaccustomed to. And they would be so exhausted and worn out from their long march that they would easily fall prey to the southerners. Liang concluded his argument with a metaphor that subsequently became famous, stating that even an arrow shot from a powerful crossbow cannot pierce even one layer of silk when it's at the very tail end of its flight and it's lost all of its momentum. In the same way, Cao Cao's mighty army would be worn out and debilitated by the time it faced Liu Bei's. Persuaded by this, Sun Quan decided to send 30,000 of his troops to support Liu Bei. As anticipated, Cao Cao and his vast host began their invasion, and they reached the banks of the Yangtze near Wulin. He planned to advance down the Yangtze River with part of his army embarked on his fleet and the rest marching along the northern bank. Now, although Cao Cao had fought many, many campaigns in the past, riverine warfare was new, both to him and to his northern troops. Knowing that they would have to fight on the river, Cao Cao had wisely tried to prepare his men by training them at rowing on a lake. But of course, still, they were no match for true experienced sailors. Furthermore, many of the men found the wet southern conditions disconcerting, and they were fatigued from their long march, just as had been foreseen. Finally, to compound their misery, disease broke out among the troops clustered in the unhealthy, low-lying, marshy land. Somewhere around this time occurred another, perhaps legendary, incident involving the renowned strategist Liang. The Allied southern forces were running short of arrows. Liang said that he would solve this shortfall, and he promised to deliver 100,000 arrows in just 3 days. Now, everyone was completely incredulous at this claim, especially because he did not ask for feathers or wood or any of the other materials that would be needed to manufacture so many arrows. Instead, Liang took just 20 ships, and he loaded their decks with big bales of hay, and he concealed these beneath black cloths. He then had those ships tied together in a line, and when a dense fog arose on the Yangtze River, he advanced with them towards where Cao Cao's fleet and his army were encamped. As the 20 ships came on, their crews were ordered to beat drums loudly. Cao Cao was wary of a trick, and he was reluctant to commit his forces to uncertain hand-to-hand fighting in the fog. So, instead, he ordered his archers to line up and shoot at the ships. Thousands of them launched arrows at the dimly perceived enemy.